The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A little bit to those announcements, or to some announcements, is the one-day sitting we have that's said, usually scheduled from 9 to 4:30, as Jim said, will end at 4:15 instead of 4:30. So in case you had your hopes. And the reason why it's cut 15 minutes off is that finally the thing that maybe some of you are most afraid of happen is that our fundraising activity has cut into our Dharma practice. So it's all uphill from here. And it'll be uphill all evening, that evening. What the IPO is about is that you know, we've been around sitting quietly for 25 years here in Silicon Valley. And while we were sitting here quietly, the mindfulness industry grew up around us. And for one evening and one evening only, we're going to claim our rightful place as leaders of this industry. And we're going to present our public offering, initial practice opportunity for everyone. And it'll coincide with listing ourselves on the New York Merit Exchange. And so you can exchange your merit back and forth as you need. And we will be talking about how we do our business and about our suppliers and our demand for our product. We have, by the way, we have a very good supply for our product. It's extremely cheap. It's very green. It's a completely recycled material. And our main product, of course, is the present moment. So we have no trouble getting supplies to that. The problem is the demand. And so Saturday, we will present to you our sales and advertisement department, which is Andrea Fella and myself, the main salespeople trying to get the demand for the present moment. And so it'll go. So this is our attempt to have fun. Every 10 years, we try to have fun at IMC. We've been here 10 years, so it's about time. And it's the whole thing is supposed to be is a fundraiser for our retreat center. And the wonderful news there is that on Friday we finally signed a contract with a contractor. It took a very long time to get all the permits and architecture plans and all the testings. So much had to be done. And finally now we have signed a contract. It took a lot of work to make it fit for the amount of money we have, and taking some things out of the project and figuring it all out. But we still need to raise money in order to finish the project. And so we have this fundraiser that's coming up on Saturday evening. So if you... could be fun. So, we just finished a retreat a few days ago, yesterday. So some of the people at the retreat are here. And for that week, I was kind of immersed in the retreat, and I'm still kind of a little bit in it. I don't know how some of you who are there, or how you feel about it, but that explains why I kind of talk about a topic that I talked about during the retreat, because it's still kind of on my mind, and hopefully I'll talk about it a little different way than the people heard about it on the retreat. And I want to talk about desire, because one of the really key things about learning to live a wise life is to understand your desire and how desire operates for you, your relationship to desire, how desire functions for you, what kind of desires you have, to understand a little bit the different kinds of desire. Desire is a multifaceted human phenomena of interest and wanting and hope and expectation and aspiration and clinging and craving, and it covers a big territory. And it's inconceivable to consider human life without desire. It's there almost all the time. Even when we're not so conscious, you wouldn't say that you have particular desire operating. Many times the basic operating system for our how we function in our life has a desire, desires deeply embedded in it that are sometimes operating subconsciously. So a wise life is one that begins looking at desire. So this should be ideally a very personal process. I don't think that it's that useful to simply listen to someone else's ideas about this topic as if that's how it is for human beings, but rather to listen to what I have to say or what someone else has to say, and then explore it for yourself. Take it as ideas with which to begin question yourself and try to understand yourself. How does desire function for you, and how does it operate? To begin, perhaps to open the window into this topic in an interesting way, is to point out that the word desire comes from Latin. And the D part is a prefix that means from. And the second part of the word comes from the Latin word for star, from the star. And I'm not sure exactly why they called it has that kind of root, but what I imagine is that people were wishing on a star. You know, you set your course, North Star, somehow. Your desire, what you want out there. And it's a little bit, you know, the idea of... So I don't know if how much this etymology is fantasy that I'm making up. The literal etymology is real, but, you know, why from Latin to English we get from the star as the meaning for desire. but I am, connecting it to the gold pot at the end of the rainbow, that we have a tremendous ability to wish for something, to project ourselves into the future for some desire, something we want, and live with that as our North Star, live and set our course for that. And sometimes it will never get there, like you never get to the gold pot at the end of the rainbow. And sometimes you do get. Sometimes desires are a very important part of life, and we set a course and we reach the end of it. People who encounter Buddhism in the West in different ways sometimes pick up the idea that Buddhism is really down on desire, and that the point of Buddhism is to help you get rid of all your desire, not to have any desire. And some people even take it one step, interesting step further, and say, well, yes, the point is to get rid of all desire, but you can't desire that because that's the one more desire. but there's nothing in teachings of the Buddha that said blanket statement that you're supposed to get rid of desire, and desire is bad. Rather, if you look at Buddhism, there's a range of different... The word desire is just a category of different similar related ways in which the mind functions. And the task of someone who does mindfulness practice is to begin looking and differentiating between the different kinds of desires we can have. And so there are healthy desires you can have, and there are unhealthy desires you can have. And I suspect that all of you in your lifetime have had experiences with both. There have probably been desires that you've followed through on that later you wished you hadn't. It wasn't for your, it could have been just as simple as going back for thirds. And then later, you wished you didn't. Or it could be a little bit more complicated, like pursuing someone successfully who you shouldn't have. And then there's the story. But there's lots of desires, and so there's healthy, there's appropriate desires, skillful desires, and there's unhealthy and unskillful ones, inappropriate ones. And then learning how to differentiate that is really important, because it's the healthy ones, we have, you know, those are, you know, not that they're necessarily to be followed and pursued, but they're not necessarily to be gotten rid of. The desire to be free of suffering, which is one of the primary desires in Buddhism, is considered to be a healthy desire. And in fact, there is no Buddhist practice without some desire like that. And to say, don't have any desires, when that's, you know, you have this desire for freedom, might do someone a tremendous disservice. I'll just go back to watch television then, you know. And the desire for freedom, freedom from suffering, freedom from clinging, freedom from fear, freedom from hate, freedom from, kind of to free the heart in some dramatic and beautiful way to experience peace, can be a very, very powerful motivating force in a person's heart. For some people, it can be the most powerful thing that's in their life. And they're going to, you know, that's what they want more than anything else. Sometimes when they want that more than anything else, it's held naively, and they end up kind of maybe pursuing that in ways that are not skillful. So there's a difference between having a particular desire and how we pursue that desire, the appropriate ways in which we pursue it. And we don't want to confuse those two. There's a difference between having a desire and how we relate to the desire, how we hold the desire. So even the most healthy desire to have can be held in an unskillful way, can be held in an unhealthy way. So I might have a desire to help my neighbor. I mean, my neighbor is sick. But I could hold that desire so tightly and so with such force that my neighbor says, get away. Because, you know, you're oppressing me with you're coming here all the time, and, you know, and you're constantly coming at three times an hour with chicken soup, you know, just getting to be too much. Or in some ways our desires sometimes are mixed. We might have desire to help our neighbor, and maybe part of it is out of compassion, but built into it is we want to be the best helper on the block. We want to get credit. We want our status to go up in the neighborhood. And so we want to make sure, it isn't just a matter of bringing the soup over to our neighbor, we want to make sure to do it at a time when the other neighbors are out and about, notice. So it's a mixed, it can be a mixed motivation. So what do we do when we have mixed motivations? Part of it which is maybe coming out of compassion, part of it that comes out of conceit. What do we do then? So one of the things it requires is to begin differentiating between desire, different kinds, and also differentiate between the desire and how we hold the desire, how we relate to the desire. So to differentiate between the kinds of desire, the primary unhealthy kind of characteristic of unhealthy desires is that there involves compulsion, clinging, grasping, and it's a desire that causes harm. So there's two things here. It's what's behind the desire, and what the consequence of the desire is. Now, what's behind the desire is a very interesting question, because if you have a desire, or when you have a desire, a very interesting question is to ask yourself, why do I have this desire? What do I want in fulfilling this desire? Because sometimes there's layers and layers of what's behind it. It might seem like an innocent thing to desire and to want, but behind it is something else. So it could be something quite nice, like it could be, for example, that I'm going shopping for groceries. So the desire is to go to the store and buy groceries. Someone asks you, what do you want to do? I want to go to the store and buy groceries. Then you ask yourself, why do you want to do it? Why do you want to do that? What are you trying to accomplish? What's the desire behind the desire to go to the store? And the desire behind it is to have food for my family. so we can have dinner tonight. And so the desire is to do something, you know, it has another purpose, not just buying food, but to feed my family. Why do I want to feed my family? What's the desire behind that? And, you know, because I care for my family, I want their health and welfare. Why do I want that? So you can keep asking. So in that situation, you kind of go through layers, and as you go through the layers, you maybe come to something which is more primary and more meaningful for us. And if you only stay at that surface level of just, I'm just going shopping for shopping's sake, we miss something much more deep. Or if I'm going shopping, and you're asking, what's driving the shopping? Why do I want to do this? What am I trying to do by shopping? And I realize I'm lonely. And I just don't want to face my loneliness. And so I'm going to shop to distract myself, to comfort myself, because acquiring things is very comforting. And then you ask behind that, why do I want to go away from my loneliness? Because I'm really afraid of facing some of the fears I have around how I live my life. I'd rather go shopping than face the fears. And so to ask what's behind the desire, what motivates a desire, is a very effective way of getting kind of closer into who we are. In Buddhism, one of the ways of evaluating ethically, the ethical evaluation of desires, is the quality of the intention behind a desire. Behind the desire, is there greed, hate, or delusion? Or is there generosity, love, or wisdom? And so if the desire is based on greed, hate, and delusion, then Buddhism says be very careful, because when it's based on that, you'll get something that you didn't anticipate. You'll get more than you asked for. It's kind of like this. If you want to get something, and there's compulsion behind that wanting, you will get something. You'll get tension. You'll get what in Buddhism is called accumulation. You build up a momentum inside of you. You build up a habit. You build up tightness. You build up a contraction. And so Buddhism has this kind of understanding that when there's clinging and grasping, that clinging and grasping sets up the underlying conditions for further stress, further discomfort. And the way this you see this work out in ancient Buddhism is that the word for clinging is upadana, and upadana also means the fuel for a fire. So to cling, the clinging itself provides the fuel for us to burn further. Make some sense? So one of the things we try to look at in Buddhism is what's the ethical quality of the desire we have? Is it motivated by things like greed and hate? What's behind the desire? What are the consequences of the desire? What's the consequence of the desire for others? Is it for the greater good of everyone? Is it just for my good and harms other people? Is it for the good of others but harms me? Can we find a way to move forward in our life that harms neither self or other, but looks for the greater good of all? And then there's healthy desires. There's beautiful desires. So my favorite word for healthy desire is aspiration. And for me, the idea of aspiration is a really beautiful thing to aspire. And a little bit I like the word because it comes from the Latin breathe, to breathe out. And I just love the breath. The breath is like a home for me. And to feel the connection to breathing as a place for some kind of healthy desire is a really nice thing for me. To be settled, grounded in my breath, and then to in myself. And then to feel the upwelling of an aspiration, of some deep intention, profound sense of desire or purpose that I want to fulfill. And it served my life tremendously well to have aspirations. The aspiration for practice, in particular, has been very meaningful for me, and I've, you know, it's guided my adult life. Compassion is an aspiration or is a desire. And so if you say you're not supposed to have any desire, then that does away with compassion, at least the Buddhist understanding of compassion, where compassion is a desire to help someone alleviate their suffering. You have a wish for that person to end their suffering. And many people consider compassion to be one of the beautiful qualities of anybody's heart, but it's a form of desire. Generosity is a desire. You have a desire to give something to someone. I think a fair amount of time, love has desire built into it. I mean, you know, there's certainly, like sexual desire. There can be desire for pleasure, but I think in loving kindness, that, or in agape kind of love, there's kind of a tenderness or desire for someone else's welfare, even if they're not suffering. Kind of like if you have a love for a child, it's kind of natural to kind of, you know, want the child well. There's kind of a well-wishing as part of that care. So these are beautiful things. Desire for practice, love, generosity, and all these things. Some of the most beautiful qualities of our social life are represented by desire. And what Buddhism says is that if you act on desires that are rooted not in greed, hate, and delusion, or in compulsion, but you act on desires that are based on generosity, love, and wisdom, that then you get something very different. That then it helps you to get more relaxed. It helps you to open up. It helps these beautiful qualities to shine forth more fully. So this is a little bit the teachings of karma. That you receive what you sow, you reap what you sow, and in the way that the psychology of our mind works, it's consequential which desires and what motivations we act on, and how we condition ourselves. But then, even with healthy desires, we can hold them in ways that are unhealthy. There can be compulsion behind it. And so one of the interesting things to explore when you're exploring your relationship desire, how it is for you, is the desire is one thing, to have a desire. The other thing is you, whatever that is. And then between you and the desire is your relationship, how you relate to it. And you probably can see that sometimes, because there are probably some times in your life where you have a desire and it's really easy to not act on it. It's like we say it's a whim. I have this whim. You know, it's kind of be nice if it happened, but it's okay if it doesn't, you know. And it just, you know, it has no, you know, and you think about it for a moment and it's easy just to forget about it. Another time there's a desire and you can't put it down. It consumes you. You can't go to sleep at night. You want something that you really want. And here, the relationship between you and the desire is one of tremendous force between the two. It's like glue between the two, or tremendous gravitational force. There's power and energy between you and the desire. Your interest and fascination and desire for it, or the hook or the pull or the attraction it has for you, you can't get yourself, and you try to let go of it, and the mind goes right back to the desire. And so to look at that, you know, so sometimes it's very powerful, sometimes it's just a whim and hardly powerful at all. And then there's a whole couple of times in between there where the desire is, you know, the pull to our desire is kind of middling. It pulls us a little bit. With a little bit of effort, we can maybe let go of it, but we have to kind of be vigilant if we want to let go of it, because we get pulled back. So what is the way you hold it? Is there compulsion? Is there strong pulling into it? So one of the interesting things to do with desire, as is with all our emotions and motivations and impulses we have inside of us, that's really, I think, one of the central features of some of the ways in which Vipassana meditation is taught here in the West. Much more so, I think, than in the way we learned it in Asia. And that is, when you have something like desire, or if you have something like fear, or anger, don't focus so much about getting rid of it or overcoming it. But take your mindfulness and turn towards it. And turn towards, like sort of, we're talking about desire tonight, turn towards the desire, whatever it might be. Turn your attention away from what it is you're desiring. And turn your attention 180 degrees around to notice what it feels like to be desiring. So rather than being obsessing about the object of your desire, turn around and look at what it feels like to be desiring. If what you want is very strong, sometimes it's hard to make that turn. But the idea is to go into the subjective experience of what it actually feels like to be desiring. And then when you can turn back and sense and feel that and look at that, then see if you can find the heart of it, the center of it, and rest there. See if you can find some way to rest into the desire. Not rest into it like you're going to give into it, but you're not going to give into it. You're going to be like a meditation. You're going to sit still and not give into it, but you're going to let yourself rest like you're going to rest back in an easy chair. You rest back into the felt sense of the desiring. It's hard. And if the desire is really strong, it's a lot of agitation and churning and spinning that's going on. So you have to kind of try to find the center of all that energy. And can you settle into it and see what happens? This is not to, this is to kind of put aside any judgments you have about the desire. It's wrong to have desire, or this is a great desire to have. I'm a bad person because I have the desire. It's to put aside any judgments about it in favor of resting in it. And again, as I said before, resting does not mean you act on it. So there's no ethical concern you need to have because you're not going to act. You're just going to sit very still and rest in the desire. Same thing with other things like fear or anger. And one of the things that helps with this process is if you can find where the desire or the fear or the anger, whatever it might be, if you can find how it shows itself up in the body. So, if there's a really strong desire, sometimes I experienced the desire sometimes in my stomach. Sometimes I felt it in my chest, a pulling. Sometimes I felt it in my head, as churning and pressure in my head, a lot of energy. Sometimes I felt it in my arms, going down my arms, just this coursing energy in my arms, like I want, do something, have it, hold it. Sometimes I felt it in my legs, like the experience of like, I just want to bolt. And there's all this energy, in my legs. So different, maybe for different kind of desires, different parts, energy centers or different kind of muscles get activated and the energy is there, the tension is there, the contraction is there, whatever it might be. And so to see if you can find what part of your body, where does the great, what's activated the most with the desire you have? And then turn your attention to feel that place in your body and rest there and see what happens. It's a very respectful thing to do because perhaps the desire you have is just the surface presentation of something that's deeper for you. Just as I said earlier, there could be layers of motivation. And if you ask, why do I want to do this? What am I trying to accomplish with this desire? And you find others layers. So it's the same thing. If you rest in your desire, it might relax and soften, and you find that underneath that desire, there's another desire or another impulse or something there. And then you can rest in that and see what shows itself and what happens. And I think that's very respectful because it respects that there's something here that wants to unfold, wants to move through you, wants to show itself. That might not be what your own ideas of what should or shouldn't happen. If you're always imposing your ideas on your life, this is what's supposed to happen, this is what should happen, this is what shouldn't happen, then you might be shortchanging yourself of some of the richness and wisdom and intelligence that exists within you from coming forth. And so I find this idea of turning towards what's happening and resting in there and being still. And being still, you know, it means a little bit like also letting the mind become still. And the analogy I like to use these days for the mind becoming still, that I think people hopefully can relate to, is if you listen to a sound that's faint and far away, sometimes you close your eyes, I think, at least I do, close your eyes, and you let the inner mind, the thinking mind, the voice inside, become quiet also so you can hear. And you can't strain too hard either. And so the same way to make it that, you kind of imagine you're listening, resting and listening deeply. So let the mind become quiet and listen your way, feel your way, rest yourself in the desire and see what happens. It also requires not giving in to the desire, because then you're up and running, but settling back into it. And it can be hard when there's a lot of restlessness in the desire. So I feel so this idea of turning towards and then seeing what transpires, see what unfolds, see what unravels is a very powerful thing. So those are my reflections about desire. I hope that in doing that I've given you some idea or two, even just one idea, that you can go spend this week with and explore desire, how it operates for you. Because I'll guarantee you, you'll have a few. And not only a few, you probably have a lot. Probably, my guess is for the majority of you, if you're really carefully mindful of what goes on in your mind, you'd come back next week and say, it was nonstop desire. So, I want to stop now. We have 10 minutes. If you would like to ask any questions or make any comments about this or give wonderful testimonials about desire or protests. Here.
Well, I don't know if this is a testimonial, but it's consistent with what you're suggesting. And very, very recently, when I've been in the grip of strong desire or agitation also, I find it helpful to open up space for that energy and for that desire. And when you do that, then it lets it spread out. And it can kind of, it doesn't dissipate the energy necessarily, but it's less intense when you do that, and you can look at it.
And as it's less intense, then you're less caught by it?
That's right.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. What about those people who have suffered from certain kind of traumas, like combat soldiers? So there's some sort of dysfunctioning inside them. What you are saying is shows a very aligned system of components, although they are, some of the components are oscillating in a non-desirable way, but for traumatic experiences, things are scrambled. So how do we approach looking at this?
So how to deal with trauma? I guess you're saying that the trauma, the mind is much more fragmented. And maybe the way I talked about looking at desire was much more linear or implied a non-fragmented system, something like that. And there's not, so trauma, you know, when it's really strong, sometimes takes particular kind of care and attention that's a little different than how we would normally do this practice here. In our particular scene, People have a lot of trauma. We refer them to a form of therapy called somatic experiencing. And somatic experiencing is not that different from Vipassana. It's just they do the mindfulness that they teach a little differently. They have particular techniques of doing it. And so one of the things they do is they teach people to go and touch their trauma very briefly and then learn how to pull back. And one of the important skills is to learn to pull back, not just to go in. And and so then people start getting some confidence that they're not going to be trapped in it, and they can actually learn how to pull back, and then they're willing to go a little bit further and feel a little bit more, rather than spiraling out of control. And so take it in small little dosages and let something begin to relax is one of the techniques of somatic experiencing. So there's a number of things to be done, but I'm not going to go into all of them, but it does require special care and a different kind of approach. Sometimes, like you know, what's something like that? You can, sometimes the kind of mindfulness practice we teach is very helpful for people, but if there's some trauma or something, sometimes it's very hard to do it alone. And so sometimes the role of a therapist or a teacher is to help you help stay present so you can do it. And the teacher's presence kind of you borrow that to stay and go through something. So what kind of, any questions about desire? In the back.
Yeah, the desire that I find very, very challenging and tricky is the desires that are within our subconscious mind that run our lives in a negative way, and the desires that you really can't get at. I've been focusing my attention on trying to root out some of those desires, but I see most of humanity involved in that. I think if someone were to wave a magic wand on somebody else and immediately wipe out all bad programming, I think it would probably reach enlightenment like within a week or so.
maybe it's the same thing as enlightenment. Yeah. But so the idea of, you know, it's true that there's all these different whether it's unconscious or subconscious, depends on people's view of how the mind works, but layers of things that are sometimes motivations that are hard to get to. And is it possible to get to all of them? I don't know. But what Buddhism posits is that it's possible to get to those which cause suffering. And whether that gives us access to everything that goes on in the subconscious or unconscious, I don't know. But the way that it's... So Buddhism posits are based on the idea that you can get to everything one way or the other. And mindfulness is one of the ways. But mindfulness and concentration, mindfulness and getting settled, the calm, unified mind and body, when we get relaxed and start feeling deeply connected to ourselves, turning towards ourselves and really feeling ourselves and resting. And we start getting concentrated in meditation. We start going through the layers in our mind. Most people live their life on the surface layers of their mind, surface thoughts and chatter. And as the mind quiets down, the surface chatter quiets down, then we have a chance to listen to the next deeper layer of thoughts, of motivations. And as that quiets down, then we have a chance to listen or feel what's deeper than that. And some of the deepest places in the operating system, conditioning we have, I like to think of it as being quite shy. And so you have to approach it with a lot of care and quiet and be pretty settled to really see what's going on. And like, for example, one of the things that, that's very hard sometimes it's obvious, you know, when it's, but is the subtle clinging to a sense of self. And that's kind of the root of a lot of desires, that holding on to self. But to get really, really, really quiet in the mind, really settled, and let all the surface chatter and the secondary chatter and the tertiary chatter is going to fall away. Be really still, really, really still, and then feel and sense the operating of ideas of self still. It's very powerful that it allows us to get to that. But it takes, this is why meditation, something like meditation can be very helpful, because again, it helps this mellowing and softening and opening and relaxing into the full system, unifying, balancing, bringing everything into balance so we can look deep in. You can't think your way in.
I find it, there's an extraordinary catch-22 to all this, because it's like we get all this conditioning, if not from our parents, from the school system, from society, that we're never good enough. And to the degree you get that is the degree of how much success or failure we have in life. And if you really consciously want to get to a better spot, you need some kind of feelings of self-worth to delve into exploring that. But if you don't have the self-worth, how do you get it there? You know, it's very...
Yeah, so what you can do is you can turn around and bring your mindfulness 180 degrees around and feel and sense the lack of self-worth and rest in the middle of it and see what happens.
Good idea.
What? It's scary?
Did I say that?
So it's scary, someone said, to do that. And so then you turn around and you bring your attention to how that's scary. And it might be that you can't get so close to the scary because it's too scary. So then you don't rest in it. But then you imagine that you're standing across a street and looking at the edges of your fear and just kind of hold and then do the kind of somatic experiencing thing. You just kind of look at it briefly and then pull away. Look at it briefly. Kind of look at the edges of it. Look at the fear of the fear. And then eventually maybe the fear of the fear can fall away and then you're just left with the fear. Anyway, so mindfulness, the way mindfulness works is the way we teach, especially here in the West, is you keep turning towards everything. Whatever it is, whatever's going on, whatever the main response or the main operating event is happening, you keep turning towards it and rest in it. Keep turning towards it and rest in it. And see what happens, see what unfolds. Make some sense? So, enjoy your desires too. Don't just make them, you know. They can be great. Oh, one more? One more. If you think the question and answer can be brief, yes?
I was just wondering for the desire to be creative all the time.
Say it again?
The desire to be creative.
All the time?
Yes.
But what about that?
Is that a distraction? Do you think that you want to be creating something all the time because you want to be distracted from confronting yourself?
It could be. I don't know. It doesn't have to be. But if you have a desire that's constant and you can't put it down, then you're not free. And so then turn toward that. In that case, that's an interesting desire. Turn towards that desire and rest in the middle of it. Don't act on it. Just rest there. See if you can be very still with it and see what happens. Because it can be a beautiful thing to desire to be creative. But chances are you'll be more creative if you know how to take a vacation from it. If you can know how to have the mind become quiet and still and free of it. And so, but in the process of exploring it, you might discover all kinds of things about you. And I know that there's going to be a lot of different motivations around being creative. So I'll tell you, if you allow me to tell you a very brief story about my creativity. I discovered art in college and just loved drawing and painting, took classes and all that. And then one day I decided that I was now an artist. And that was the day I stopped doing art. Because then I couldn't do art with the motivation to do it because I was an artist. So, okay, so thank you all.